Hello and good time of day to you. This is Matthew Barnard, the editor of the BSP podcast and also the secretary of the society. I've just got a few announcements to make before this episode, which is of Niall Keane and his paper at our annual conference last year. The first announcement is our conference this year, which is on the 23rd of July and runs until the 25th of July. That's in the University of Kent. And also next week we've got a workshop on the philosophy of the body, focusing on, among other things, Merleau-Ponty, the applicability of phenomenology to neuroscience, and also to medicine and mental health. The highlight of that event is that we've got speaking Professor Raymond Tallis. You can find information about both of those events on our website, which is britishphenomenology.org.uk. The next announcement is that Patrick O'Connor, who is a member of the executive of the society, and he's also someone who's been on a couple of episodes of the podcast. I interviewed him a few weeks back about his work in Cormac McCarthy, and we have one of his papers on that topic as well. He set up his own podcast where he interviews different people, including Raymond Tallis, also the president of the BSB, Keith Crome, and many other interesting intellectuals. I'm personally looking forward to listening to it. There's an episode up already, and I think he's going to be releasing those weekly for the next few months. If you want to find it, it's called Thales Well. So if you just type in Thales Well with an apostrophe after the S into your podcast app, it should come up, and I hope you enjoy it. Anyway, thank you for subscribing to the BSP, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
And I'm really, really pleased to be able to introduce the first of our speakers for this session, Niall Keane from Mary Immaculate College. And Niall's going to talk to us about effective demonstration and speaking communally, the practice of rhetoric. So, thank you.
Thank you. So the title of the paper, or at least the subtitle, is on this notion of blocked possibilities that Heidegger uses in the contributions to philosophy, but I'm going to try and read it back into these earlier lectures. So Heidegger's 1924 lecture, entitled The Basic Concepts of Aristotelian Philosophy, analyzes rhetoric and the core concepts of Aristotle's practical philosophy, more specifically how something meaningful is disclosed practically by way of speaking with and to others. Yet in a provocative opening remark, he claims that his lecture course has, I quote, no philosophical aim whatsoever, and is simply interested in understanding basic concepts in their conceptuality, end of quote. He then adds that the aim is purely philological, in that it intends to bring the reading of philosophers somewhat more into practice. Yet when it comes to his examination of Aristotle, we should perhaps be less interested in what he said about his own lecture courses and instead follow the orientation of his own analysis. So let me begin by examining the nature of his rehabilitation of rhetoric and its practical effective dimension before moving on to the more substantive issue of how his interpretation of rhetoric lays the foundations for his later critique of the metaphysical priority accorded to actuality over possibility. To examine his analysis of rhetoric, it is important to note the emphasis he places on rhetoric being more accurately definable in terms of a dunamis, that is, a potential or a possibility, namely discovering the possible means of persuasion, than it is as a craft or a techne. Rhetoric, thusly understood, is a capacity to concretize the diverse ways of speaking that disclose something to someone and, to a lesser degree, a means of persuasion. Unlike other technae, then, such as medicine, geometry, or arithmetic, when it comes to rhetoric, Heidegger is clear that there is no clearly demarcated subject area with specific objects of study pertaining to this area. And for this reason, rhetoric does not primarily have the function of mere persuasion, but rather it identifies through what Heidegger terms its practical knowing its way about, the most appropriate means of disclosing something to the listener, something which speaks for the matter, as he puts it. Heidegger affirms then that rhetoric's aim is to make the thing evident in its substantive character. Moreover, it is the very notion of possibility, dunamis, which allows one to distinguish rhetoric from sophistry, the latter focusing not on letting the matter speak for itself, but on the unqualified intention to gain the upper hand, of making weak arguments appear stronger, to quote Plato, by means of unjust logos that exploits the right moment to do so. So what Aristotle calls then the endoxic character of rhetoric, how it takes its start from established belief, is thus represented in the proper use of pistes, the possible means of persuasion, which in the parallel field of dialectic are termed syllogisms. Pistis, then, is not simply about belief, but is a form of practical demonstration, Heidegger argues, one that is hopefully taken to heart by the listener. This means that while an expert in theoretical syllogistic logic is distinct from an expert in the practice of rhetoric, the two share something fundamental in common, which allows one in principle to be an expert in both. In the end, the analogous nature of these two fields of logos, rhetoric and dialectic, practice and theory, is found in their overlapping and yet distinct approaches to the question of demonstrable truth, which is disclosed either by logical proof or practical effective demonstration. Aristotle's claim, then, is that rhetoric is not a techne, or at least not merely a techne, and contains nothing technical. Actually, that's more Heidegger's claim about Aristotle. I think Aristotle would say it's also clearly a techne, but is instead a way of being led by the matter under discussion, emphasizing how this form of logos is bound up with the available means of coming to be persuaded by evidential reality. It is for this reason that Heidegger states that logos is the fundamental mode of our being in the world, which does not mean that the world is grasped conceptually first and foremost, but that the world is the space of appearances that correspond to true speaking. It is from this that Heidegger claims, with Aristotle, that logos constitutes the ontological basis of our being with others. So his interest in Aristotle's rhetoric, then, is therefore exclusively concerned with understanding a manner of speaking that gives us access to the defining phenomena of our speaking and embodied being with others. As such, rhetoric discloses something in a situated context, and it allows one to see and understand the difference between something experienced in its evidential self-givenness and how it is founded in the world of speaking together effectively and practically. Rhetoric allows us to catch sight of the available means of coming to be persuaded, which contributes to the vetting of our shared convictions about the world. This early lecture attests unequivocally, then, to Heidegger's attempts to interpret Aristotle as a proto-phenomenologist, one who equips phenomenology with the means of examining the connection found also in being and time between the uncovered being true of something, the manner of its being disclosed to some, and the manner of its being disclosed to the understanding as true. In fact, Heidegger's early lecture on Plato's Sophist, which took place in the following semester, or in the semester following the lecture on Aristotle's rhetoric, puts forward the same connection between the manifestation of truth and the essence of human understanding. Truth is a determination of the essence of Dasein, we're told, understood as an affected and responsive discloser, and truth is uncovered in a determinate way by speaking. Hence, every manner of disclosing truth occurs by way of speaking, a meta-logo. In sum, then, the relationship between rhetoric and conceptual thinking is one that allows us to distinguish what is uncovered, objectivity, and what enables it to manifest its shared sense and become intelligible to a community. What defines the philosophical originality of Heidegger's interpretation here is his insistence with which he claims Aristotle's rhetoric is the expression of a dynamic thinking together, which allows us to make the distinction between the field of uncovering, namely ontology, and the disclosive access point to this uncovering, namely Dasein. Therefore, in many ways, Heidegger is finding ample alternative resources within the metaphysical tradition to counterbalance what he sees as an excessively one-sided dialectical tendency to arrive at theoretical truths which are true in an unqualified sense, or at least true for the most part. And yet, in these early lectures, Heidegger insists that rhetoric and dialectic are fundamentally discursive capacities or faculties, dunamis, while theoretical scientific thinking strives for a knowledge of real things, pragmata. What makes rhetoric unique, however, is that it exhibits a poietic character, a productive element, and simultaneously a demonstratively scientific character. Namely, it facilitates knowledge of real things which have been rendered thematic. Rhetoric exhibits a specific form of logos, then, or practical knowing, analogous to but distinct from scientific knowing, insofar as it structures arguments differently and draws attention to the evidential nature of experienced truth. Hence, a good rhetorician, in Heidegger's view, can see what speaks for the matter itself. And the rhetorician then can subsequently lead the listener to an appropriate conviction regarding the matter up for discussion. It is the great merit of Heidegger, I believe, to have drawn our attention to an approach to evidential truth and practical effect which fell out of favour for centuries. Prior to Arendt and Gadamer, it is Heidegger who drew our attention to the fact that we are genuinely human only insofar as we exist with others in the truth disclosed discursively. And it is at this point that pure phenomenology becomes phenomenological hermeneutics. The upshot here is that speaking with one another, where others are themselves speaking, is what establishes the being common, the being in common of all things. Unlike the overwrought rhetoric of the later Heidegger, under the guidance of Aristotle, he insists that the most fundamental issues of philosophy, on what there is and how it is given or rendered intelligible, is essentially tied to our embodied, practically effective living together. Practical effects, then, which constitute the soil from which speaking and being together emerge, are how the human being is turned towards itself and how the human being finds itself precisely in finding itself turned towards another. This turning towards oneself is no mere procedural self-apprehension, however, but rather a fundamental finding of oneself with others in speaking of what is in common. He sees then in rhetoric a hermeneutic of concrete existence and praises the Greeks for recognizing that discursiveness is first a characteristic of human life and that philosophy forgetfully sinks its roots into the soil of practical understanding when developing its elaborate metaphysical systems. Yet Heidegger also claims that philosophy has lost touch with this soil. His aim then is to show that theoretical metaphysical thinking as a fundamental approach to beings as actualized structurally inhibits a reflection on other modes of disclosing, and most crucially, a reflection on disclosing itself, or as such. But I will return to this later. For Heidegger, Aristotle's thought provides him what he terms a jolt to the present and for the future. It allows us to comprehend the foundations of scientific thinking and philosophical knowing in lived speech, which takes its start from being affected by the self-givenness of what is other. Because of this, Heidegger decides to develop a fundamental ontology of practical lived pathos, as opposed to an ontology of actualized presence, mainly because we are firstly embodied, self-disclosing beings attuned in different and yet analogous ways to one another. This means that we can be moved and guided by the right words, not unjust words, but the right words, that make the matter under discussion evident in its substantial character. Effects are therefore bound up with living with one another and are significant insofar as they are practical determinations of the being together of speaker and hearer. However, it is a truism to state that everyone is necessarily with others in the world, hence that effects participate in the doxastic formation grounded in living with one another and not merely alongside one another is characterized by Heidegger as living in an average and everyday way by doxa. Interestingly, however, he also characterizes effects as a means of arriving at a concrete and practical self-understanding, which would be impossible without such living with one another. Without what is common, we would be, as he puts it, fish caught in a stream. Speaking with one another reciprocally, then, is the very condition of deciding something genuine for oneself and of swimming against this stream. And as early as 1924, he's grappling with the productive tension that exists between authenticity and inauthenticity, non-relationality and relationality, speaking and the distortions of speaking. The claim being made here is clear. The human being is not primarily understandable in terms of its autonomous self-relatedness, but nonetheless has the non-substitutable possibility of deciding something for itself authentically, of expressing a genuine drive towards what Heidegger terms the hexus with respect to the uncoveredness of its own being. It is explicit in these lectures that Heidegger is focused on a way of being towards others and towards oneself and with appearing in such a way that one's appearing with others is not a distorted appearing to others, but a genuinely practical being in common with others. Thanks to his interpretation of the rhetoric, he finds in the pathos of doxa not what is epistemically impoverished, but the very source of being together in that which can be otherwise, namely the constitutive phenomena of everydayness outlined in Being and Time. It is out of this context that he writes in Being and Time that, I quote, Aristotle's rhetoric must be understood as the first systematic hermeneutics of the everydayness of being with one another. End of quote. What this means then is that the world appears for us as co-disclosed by others. Thus, the pathos of doxa is the transformative impetus, of the open-ended speaking with one another about what is to be done, namely praxis, and to be concerned with life's self-actualization as the unfolding of possibilities which we are obliged to be. One thing that I've only touched on thus far is how Heidegger's analysis of rhetoric is tied to his attempts to offer a critique of the metaphysical concept of actuality by way of the pathos of doxa. And it is only by going back to these early Aristotle lectures that the later being and time claim that that possibility is higher than actuality can be made sense of. In spite of the obvious importance of possibility in his magnum opus, it would nevertheless have been quite difficult for its first readers to appreciate the breadth of the critique of actuality that Heidegger lays out. Yet in retrospect, this critique seems to be contained within these early lectures. As early as 1924, he is drawing on Aristotle's rhetoric in order to undam a blocked possibility. This means that the metaphysical theoretical perspective on beings has blocked another effectively grounded practical understanding of possibility. Yet the historical configuration of beings suggests something more, namely that the blocked possibility in question is not just one possibility amongst others, but is a more original possibility that is of a different order, incompatible with the modalities of metaphysical actuality. Indeed, for Heidegger, this incompatibility extends to any interpretation of being in terms of beings that are ultimately understood as present actualized entities, whether these are taken to be produced by God, by nature, or by a subject. Thus, on the one hand, the metaphysical thinking of actuality is not a banal danger that can be sidestepped with ease. On the other hand, the blockage is not so total that the reflection on another way of conceiving possibility is impossible. His attack on metaphysical conceptions of modality, then, thereby takes as its first target the traditional priority accorded to actuality over possibility. The problem here seems first and foremost to be the way in which the metaphysical tradition has, almost without exception, defined possibility and necessity in terms of actuality. One version of this priority of actuality, stemming from Aristotle, it must be said, although quite importantly not the Aristotle of the rhetoric, is that to any possibility there must correspond an existing active or passive power of actualization. Another view, also traceable to Aristotle, is that possibility can be defined in terms of what is at least sometimes actual, while necessity corresponds to what is always actual. In this way, actuality holds first rank in the metaphysical order of things, not only by virtue of its intrinsic priority, which is largely conceded as soon as truth is understood as unconcealment, and unconcealment is understood as presence, but also in the relative extensions of its subordinate terms. Possibility and necessity then constitute the total spectrum of actuality, running from the sometimes actual to the always actual. They guarantee, as it were, that actuality exhausts all being, up to and including that which is not in the form of the not yet actual. Everything, even what is not yet, is reduced to the order of actuality, like points on a scale running from remote possibility through common possibility up to fullest actuality. In the background of his interpretation of the rhetoric, he is laying the foundations for his examination of the unquestioned presence and actuality of objects to subjects, as well as the subject's presence to itself. His question or questions are then, how is it that there are objects and subjects for each other at all? And secondly, what is the origin of the there-ness that lies at the basis of objective knowledge and of the fundamental experience of things? And at the same time, and in the same questioning, he takes aim at the unhelpful differentiation between beings and being that metaphysics has always claimed to be their foundation. In conclusion, the deep-running attack on metaphysical modality in the name of a deeper and more essential blocked possibility traverses Heidegger's writings and is easy enough to spot when you know what you're looking for. His reading of the rhetoric, the practical exercise of speaking and hearing together, and his analysis of pathos is a splendid example of this. Of course, the near total dominance of metaphysical thinking in the last 2.5 millennia, evidenced by the very marginal status of Aristotle's rhetoric in the history of philosophy, poses certain problems, among which is the fact that there is absolutely no guarantee that what is possible will ever come to pass. In this regard, the brittleness of thinking and the provisional nature of philosophical experience, still under the influence of metaphysics, are common themes in Heidegger's work, often coupled with more than a tinge of gloom. Here again, amidst all the doom and gloom, what is strikingly original is that the configuration of something Heidegger holds to be distinctly possible and in the same sense, hidden within the history of metaphysics, alive within Aristotle's rhetoric, perhaps, namely the possibility of reconceiving the essence of possibility, starting with a renewed reflection on speaking and practical effect. Yet this reconceiving is itself also blocked, possibly to the point of its continual repression. On the one hand, such a possibility is clearly a real possibility, insofar as real is opposed to logical, formal, metaphysical, fantastical, and so forth. And yet, on the other hand, insofar as it is structurally inhibited by metaphysical thinking, it remains unreal, in the specific sense that the conditions of its realization are by and large out of reach. Such is the nature of blocked possibility that defines, I would like to claim, Heidegger's work from beginning to end, along with his attempts to uncover the possibility of possibilities as such. His interpretations of Aristotle's rhetoric are precisely early attempts to focus on a blocked possibility, which is no longer ontologically subordinate to actuality and necessity, and to undam this possibility where and when possible. Thank you.